Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. For those of you who don't know, these Soapbox editions are wholly sponsored. That means everyone you hear in one of these shows paid to be here, or at least their employers paid us for them to be here. In this edition of the Soapbox, we're chatting with Steve Miller, the head of threat intelligence at Stairwell. Steve has a long history of doing this sort of stuff. He worked inside various bits of the US government doing cyber things, and also spent a decent chunk of his career at Mandiant, so he knows a thing or two about the cybers. His new employer, Stairwell, is basically a platform that collects information about all the files present in your environment and lets you do some fancy stuff with that information. You'll hear a little bit more about what they do in this interview, but we're not really talking all that much about Stairwell today. It's more a conversation about the evolution of threat intelligence. As you'll hear, Steve says the first iteration of the commercial threat intel space was very much born of govies jumping out of those government roles and bringing their thinking and TTPs with them, but the space is now evolving. And my takeaway from this interview is that threat intelligence these days, it's more something that you do, not something that you just blindly consume as a feed of strings, be they IP addresses, domains, or hashes. Anyway, here's Steve Miller, who started off by giving us his take on the early threat intel industry. I do hope you enjoy this conversation.
Well, so I'm just always thinking about kind of the threat intel space and how it's evolved over the years. And I was thinking back to how, you know, what it is made of today are a lot of companies and a lot of people and a lot of processes that emerged originally from the government intelligence space before private sector threat intel was a thing. You know, this is like going back to the early 2000s, I guess, when, you know, China was on the rampage big time against US companies and defense industrial sector and all that. And the government wasn't really able to do anything. Government was really just not there to help the private sector. And so then a lot of analysts left the government and kind of filled this vacuum of the private sector incident response space and the private sector threat intelligence space. And I just think that's really interesting. And I think, like, you know, because of that, the threat intel space today, you know, has this government legacy that it's kind of living out in terms of how it defines intelligence and what it is that it is producing and what it's giving out to its various consumers. And I think the evolution has been really cool. And I think the reason I think about it so much now is because, you know, now that I step back from, you know, my time at Mandiant doing threat intel stuff, and I'm seeing all these companies pop up all over the place. Everybody's got threat intel offerings that they're starting to bring to the table. And I'm starting to wonder, like, what that means from a consumer perspective. You know, you're out there buying threat intel. Like, what does it mean for more offerings to be out there? You know, is the demand for threat intelligence changing? And are the products themselves changing and what people are offering and what they're getting back? And I don't know. I just think it's like, it's kind of an interesting thing. And
I mean, I'm interested already, right? Because I was around when, you know, a lot of this got kicked off, I suppose, well, accelerated by the APT1 report, right? From Mandiant, which, when was that? Like 2011 or something?
The report officially came out in 2013, I think early in 2013.
Yeah.
But it was
really
based on like the like absolute rampage from 2008, right? And maybe even before up to that point when it was like just the bodies were stacked pretty high from a breach perspective.
I remember, look, for those who aren't familiar with the APT1 report, because it has been a while now and not everyone's been in this industry for a long time. I mean, it was the first sort of, you know, public doxing of an APT crew by the private sector. And it was really a game-changing moment. And I still remember some things in that report, like just looking at the connectivity available to this APT1 crew and the amount of traffic they were pushing around gave you some idea of the scale that they were operating at. But this is an interesting way to look at how threat intelligence kind of evolved, right? So you got a bunch of people with a bunch of different skills in government who say, well, okay, clearly the government's not prioritizing doing this work, so we're going to go out and do it on our own. And they basically brought a lot of their mindsets and TTPs with them. I guess that's what you're saying. But now we're seeing, I guess, the next evolution in that, which is this is turning perhaps into more of a private sector thing that's not so deeply rooted in its government origins.
Yeah, and I think that's probably for a good thing. Like, you know, going back to, I don't necessarily know that people knew that the cyber threat intel space was actually going to grow, but they knew 100% that incident response and malware analysis was going to be huge, right? And it was a massive need. And so you had, you know, people leaving, you know, Kevin Mandia leaving the government and starting Mandiant. You had people like my CEO, Mike Wiasek, you know, starting up Tag inside of Google to perform, you know, kind of a threat intel capability. You have CrowdStrike, you know, starting up its incident response routes. But I don't think people really knew what they were going to do with all that incident response stuff. But the undertaking and the autopsies that they were performing, you know, effectively on malware in these companies. And they were realizing, well, you know, by studying all this stuff, we can not only like respond better, but actually we can sell it. We can sell it and people are going to want to buy this stuff because they don't want to become victims as well. And so like early on, you know, incident response companies were kind of, they had jumped AV really quickly, right? Because AV was part of the problem back then. It had failed and breaches had happened. Now you got the incident responders saying, we have all this great information that AV isn't able to use or isn't using effectively. And we can help you, you know, we can help you on top of what they already have. So we're going to sell you indicator feeds, right? We're going to sell you hashes and other types of things that are going to leave you better protected where AV really isn't cutting it.
But did they? Right. I mean, this is the thing. This has always been the fundamental challenge with threat intelligence feeds is coverage, right? This is just a different type of block list, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people didn't really know even what the AV vendors were doing, maybe at the time. What were those AV agents doing? They were doing a lot of the same things that end up also in the threat intelligence feeds, which is part of the problem. And one of the things, and I've produced tons, you know, I'm guilty of every shortcoming of threat intelligence that there is, and a lot that we don't even have names for yet. But like with indicators in particular, whether it's a domain or an IP or a hash, you know, vendors are producing these and giving these to you, and they're not really sure what you're going to use it for. Maybe you run it against logs, maybe you block it, maybe whatever. But a lot of people don't think about the latency that is part of that intelligence production process. So, you know, how long from, you know, when that thing was used to the time you get it in a hash feed, you know, what is that latency like? And in some cases it's years. And in some cases years is far too long for it to even be, you know, effective at all.
But I mean, this is kind of my point, right? Which is that AV at the time, I mean, it's got better, right? Most of those AV companies now, they offer some form of, you know, blended AV / EDR thing, and they're generally a lot more useful. And we can thank companies like Silence and CrowdStrike for giving the AV industry the kick in the pants that it oh so desperately needed. But I do wonder about the utility of threat intelligence as a must-have versus being a nice-to-have. Like, it doesn't strike me as ever having been tremendously useful as a primary control. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of that has to do with,
or as a way of, you know, feeding, making your primary controls useful, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, what consumers can do with what they buy. Right. And so if you're out there and saying, I want to buy threat intelligence, you want to buy a thing that's like most easily operationalized. And for most people, those are the things that are most easy to just like, you know, plug and play into your existing technology. And I think that's why that type of product has intelligence product has been the most common and still is today, right? But I do agree that I don't think it was ever really as effective as what it was kind of how it was portrayed. And I think that actually led to a lot of the other things that we kind of saw in the post IOC world. Not that we're there, but like, right. But hashes and IPs and domains started to dominate, but then all these other things started to come out to play, right? When people were starting to get tired of indicator feeds, I think intelligence companies were like, hey, well, have you heard about TTPs yet?
Yeah, and I mean, this right. is what I was thinking, right? This conversation is obviously headed towards how MITRE ATT&CK is a new thing and actually quite useful.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's like a really good evolution to have, right? And it's a sign that, you know, consumers are making their voices heard and saying like, you know, yo, I'm tired of paying for these hash feeds because I know that these things get to me far too slowly to be useful. Their half-life is so short that like I'm never going to see this stuff. And so the value is just not really there. But when you start to move, you know, along that spectrum of whatever into TTPs and you have things like MITRE ATT&CK and, you know, where does that information come from and how does that help you defend your enterprise? And that's become kind of a cool thing. I'm a fan of MITRE ATT&CK. I say that
we are huge fans of MITRE ATT&CK here. I mean, the tricky part is actually, I mean, applying controls. It's easy on the control part, right? MITRE ATT&CK is really good for figuring out controls. When it comes to detecting behaviors, that's when it gets a little bit harder, right? Because you go, oh, okay, I want something that can detect, you know, these three things. And, you know, there isn't anything that you can buy that'll just tick those boxes for you yet. I mean, that'll change, but it's, yeah, implementing the detection part of MITRE ATT&CK seems to me to be the tricky bit.
Right, right. And so, you know, this goes back to like, there's a lot balled up inside of MITRE ATT&CK itself because, you know, MITRE ATT&CK, you know, was initially designed to mimic some of the TTP, you know, frameworks that a lot of other people had been using, but it was kind of a simplified version of that.
Babby's first matrix.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so it was kind of simplified and it's actually gotten a lot better, you know, through people being like, yo, you know, we need it to be a little bit more granular and it has the sub techniques now and stuff. One of my major frustrations with ATT&CK in particular is that there's not a lot of information out there about how common a specific thing is. Right. So no, there's no guidance on how to prioritize. You can't do all the things, right? Mm. There's 1,000 techniques and there's not a lot of information from intelligence vendors to say, well, this is the most common one. These are the top 10, you know, that, you know,
but I mean, isn't that because it's hard? There's so much nuance here that
it's hard.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Because yeah. One of the most common things might not really apply to you because it's being used by a threat actor that just isn't interested in your vertical or your department, right. Type of department or whatever. Right. So it's, and that's the thing. That's another thing where, you know, threat intelligence has always kind of fallen down a bit is you always needed really specific threat intelligence tailored to you as a target. And that spread everyone a little thin. Like it's hard to come by. I mean, maybe if you're a bank, you're going to get something useful there, but I don't know. What if you're the world's leading manufacturer of toilet seats? I don't know. You're just worried about ransomware, right?
What MITRE ATT&CK techniques apply to you? I don't know, but it is frustrating that I just don't think a lot of intelligence vendors have tried to wrap numbers around any of this. You know, what if you were to just take malware and say, what is the most common persistence mechanism in malware?
Yeah.
No one's got an answer for you. No one will even try. I'll take a swag and say it's registry run keys. But you know, we just don't have any numbers because those numbers are not things that people really want to try to produce because counting is really hard and all the data biases.
But it's funny, right? Because I mean, I see your point. Like, this is stuff that you would think, you know, we should know. I mean, there's a lot of these small emperor has no clothes moments when you've been in InfoSec long enough, right? Where you're just like, huh, yeah, that's weird. We should know that.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of like gets to what I think. Well, so years after MITRE ATT&CK came out, right? It was actually one of CrowdStrike's first reports where they did like a heat map of ATT&CK techniques they saw in their incident response things over the year. And I thought that was so cool. And I was like, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And obviously it's only based on their data, and it's only, it has all these, you know, regional biases and threat actor biases, yada, yada, yada. But it was a stab at it. And I thought that was really cool. But that kind of gets to like, that gets this next level of intelligence where it's beyond just what threat actors are doing. We're starting to wrap kind of perspective in with the bad things that are seen, because the global perspective, right? The global prevalence of a technique or a piece of malware or a file. And this is like an, I think this is next level type of security knowledge that's beyond the known bad type of stuff. This is where like the worldly data starts to get measured against each other. We could start to give consumers an idea of how rare something is, how important something is, and that type of stuff. And that's kind of like where I see a lot of the
You mean threat intelligence should actually look like intelligence instead of a list of strings? That's a crazy idea, Steve.
Yeah, well, you know,
you want it, you want it to actually be useful beyond, you know, being able to match a file hash? Nah.
Yeah. You would, it seems nuts, right? But but like I always get frustrated too, because like, you know, and I produce all this stuff. I write these long form reports with huge paragraphs of eloquent prose where I'm just blowing people's minds and techniques no one's ever heard of and things that are not in a matrix or a hash, not even hashable, right? But those things are really hard for most intelligence consumers to digest. Like, even if you buy a subscription of intelligence reporting, it's like, here's what the latest greatest APTs are doing. You have to also have an intelligence analyst read that. You know, you got to pay for someone to like digest it for you,
to interpret it. Yeah.
And then you have to also have detection engineers being like, well, what can we do from this perspective and that perspective and get visibility on this type of data and create these analytics for that type of thing. And so
I mean, I think, hang on, I just want to go back, right? Because we started off talking about, you know, APT1 back then. I think when APT actors were so lazy and there were a lot fewer of them, I think maybe, you know, the threat intel industry definitely did serve a useful function back then, right? You know, I've spent years sort of crapping on threat intel as a major industry focus. Well, I do think there's too much of a focus on threat intel as the solution to all of our problems, right? But I think that's probably rooted in the fact that when it first came along, it revealed to us the extent of APT activity, right? Particularly from China, like as you were saying, and helped mop up a lot of that stuff as well, right? And kind of briefly made life a little bit harder for the adversaries. But I guess really what we're saying in this conversation is that old way of doing things, you know, it's of limited value now. I mean, do you think that's a reasonable summary of what we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes or so?
Yeah. I think it's like, we're getting diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Right. And people want something different, and they want things that are faster and easier to apply and more meaningful, but like longer lasting. You know, so like if you're out there and you're shopping around for threat intel today, you have no ability to compare vendors against one another. You don't know who has the most intelligence. You don't know who gets the same intelligence more quickly. You don't know who produces more quality intelligence. And you just don't know what it's going to cost for you to take all of that and apply it. You have no idea
hard for you to give someone an IP address. And we've seen this in the case of major incidents where, say, some sort of government cert or government, you know, cybersecurity agency will pass out a list of 5 IPs and say, you know, these 5 IPs are associated with a nation state actor that is doing untold damage to your vertical. Go.
Yep.
And people take these IPs and they're like, what am I supposed to do with this? Because we're still at the point we're trying to operationalize this stuff still in 2022. The year 2022, yeah. It is still hard for people to actually, you know, be able to get value out of these indicators. That's a bit depressing.
Well, it's not, maybe not the worst thing in the world. At least this means that we know a lot about threat actors. We know far more. We know far more than we did in the past. And the state of the field of threat intelligence is like really good. It's really good. We're learning a lot. We know a lot of things. And now we're waiting for that that second piece, like the productization and operationalization or something like that, like is going to have to catch up. And I think a lot of those things like log searching and blah, 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 like those things were much more expensive in the past than they are today. And so maybe we're just playing some catch up, and we could do things now today that we really couldn't even do 10 years ago because it was prohibitively expensive to be able to apply things to all of your data.
Mm. Now, obviously, one of the reasons we're talking about this is because Stairwell, the company that you're working for now, is, you know, it's one of those companies that allows you to actually roll your own. You know, you say never roll your own crypto. I think never roll your own threat intel might not hold, actually, because, you know, because as we were just saying, you know, everything's sort of context dependent, and quite often you're going to find unique threats in your environment. If you're dealing with an attacker with half a brain, they're probably using unique malware, you know, at least unique compiles of malware in your stuff. They might have spun up fresh infrastructure with fresh domains using different registrant IDs and whatever, right? So you might not catch them. But if you've got a thread to pull, there are now tools that allow you to do that. Stairwell's one of them. For those, I mean, we did do a Snake Oilers sort of pitch talking about Stairwell last year, but you know, why don't you refresh the listeners' memories on what it is that Stairwell actually does? Because it's a pretty simple idea.
Yeah. So Stairwell is the name of the company. Our platform that we produce is called Inception. And in many ways, you know, it can be thought of like as a file search and explore type of platform at the onset. So we have...
I did tease Mike, by the way, and told him he should have called it File Explorer.
File Explorer would have been great.
It would have been. But I think there's a few trademark issues there. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. So we have, you know, kind of a lightweight file forwarding agent, right? And we just collect a whole lot of files from the endpoints. And we, you know, we specify what those are. You know, I think mainly we're focused on things that are much more likely to be malware, like executables. And then we bring them back into the cloud and we parse them and we allow you to search them. We connect the existence of a file with the file path and the file name. And then we connect it to the assets, you know, the computers that actually possess it. So what we're creating is kind of like this graph for your own enterprise data as it exists on your assets. And that's before we start to look at, you know, making any sort of decisions as to what is good, bad, or ugly. And this opens up a lot of possibilities, you know. So one of the core kind of components of what we're trying to do is, you know, we use Yara in addition to all of our other type of special sauce and magic. But, you know, you can run Yara rules across all of your, you know, all of your enterprise files that are, you know, that are executables. And you can, you know, if you purchase, you know, a threat intelligence subscription that includes Yara rules, boom, you got a place to apply them. Because a lot of times, you know, that type of stuff is really hard to put across your own data. And I think we're kind of coming up with new and curious ways to do that.
Yeah, so that was actually going to be something I was going to ask you about, right? Because as everyone just heard, the pitch is really simple, right? You've basically got a directory which lists all of the files in your environment on every system that is running your, you know, very lightweight file forwarding agent. Although I'm glad you're actually calling it an agent these days.
I'll call it what it is. Yeah.
Thank you. But yeah, so that's the idea. Just get it all in one place. You know, but where's your advantage there? I mean, I imagine it's like if you get a hit on some malware and you can say, okay, where is it? And you can find every single box there where that file is present. But beyond that, I imagine there's some use cases as well. So why don't we talk about what they look like?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we were talking about MITRE attack and techniques, you know, when you're done searching with the indicators, when you've looked at all the hashes of all the files and you've looked at all the IPs and domains, you're starting to look at that next step. Well, what has everything missed? And you have techniques to go search your own files. And you could take things like, let me search for all executable files that have XOR encoded content in them, because I know that's a common technique of malware. And I just want to look at everything that does that.
So this is fancy, right? Like last time I spoke to Mike, I don't think that was in the product. Is that relatively new?
Well, this could be done with Yara, right?
Oh, okay, so, right. Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. You. I didn't. Yeah. See, I'm, being not a threat hunter, being an actual podcaster, well, so I don't know that you can do this fancy stuff with Yara.
You can do all sorts of crazy stuff with Yara. I say, in speaking English, you know, you could write a haiku or you could write an Odyssean epic, right? Or anything in between. You can express a lot of these things in Yara, and we're really interested in doing that because it gives analysts the flexibility to ask these really complicated questions of their data and to ask them the way they want to ask them and to get answers back that are really difficult to get back from a lot of security products because of how in most security products, the data is really down selected. So when you down select the data to a certain degree, you know, you just lose all of that ability to make good sense of what you're seeing and what you're not seeing. And so like those things we can do in Yara where we'll deploy a Yara rule and any new file that comes in matches across it. If I deploy a Yara rule, it'll go against the entire historical corpus, which I think is really cool. Like, in terms of like building these little haystacks of how to find evil. But what's more, and this is where I get stoked because I'm such an advocate for this idea of like prevalence. You know, for a given file, you should understand how common it is in your organization, period, hard stop. If you can't tell me how many systems this file is on, like that's crazy. It's your data, it's your environment. You should know these things. And I think like I'm looking at it where you start to measure and look at really rare things because you're not down selecting the data as much, you start to have this better insight as to what is unique and what is rare inside your own environment. And that's a different type of security knowledge than traditional IOCs and threat intel.
I mean, one thing I like here too, right, is if you throw a Yara rule at your, and I'm going to call it the Yara rules. I'm going to call them Yara rules because I grew up in Melbourne and the main river that runs through Melbourne is the Yara. And that even confuses the crap out of other Australians who come to Melbourne and call it the Yara. But no, it's Yara. It's Yara. One thing you can do too, say you're searching, you know, with some Yara rule through your corpus, you see something that might just look a bit odd. Because you've centralized that corpus of files, you can then do stuff like throw that file into a sandbox, right, and see what pops out. And just being able to do that as a something that from start to finish is a 10-second thing, fire rule, oh, that's weird, sandbox it. That just saves you a lot of time, you know?
Yeah, having these things centralized and searchable in one place and then, you know, taking that thing and measuring it against other things is really, it's like, incredible to have that in one spot. And that's like the whole reason I came to this company was to, you know, to grow and like snowball this idea and do the things that I really wanted to do and ask the questions that I wanted to ask of the data. And to me, like the global prevalence is such a huge thing. You know, when you take a look at something like the sunburst implant, right, from the SolarWinds thing, how many systems in the enterprise do you think that was on? It was only on one. Right. And, you know, I can go say, just show me all the executables.
But wouldn't that make sense, though? Like if you've only got one SolarWinds instance,
right,
it's going to make sense that it's only in one place because that's the only place you'd expect to get a SolarWinds update.
Absolutely. But more to my point is that it's like,
I get it though, man. If you're seeing an executable, it's on every box, right? You know that it's legit. If it's on half of your boxes, you're either getting absolutely rinsed, in which case you would have some other indication, or it's just software that half of your users use. If you see like five instances of something that doesn't appear to have any sort of function, yeah, that's a thread to pull on, right?
Yeah, but also imagine it's like, you know, as we go down this road and we get more data, you know, you're looking at your enterprise and I'm looking at mine. What if you could say, what is the prevalence within my enterprise
versus
what
this
is
other
the
one?
Global prevalence.
So but I mean, even I that, okay. Say, so let me ask you this, right? Say I do a frequency analysis on the binaries. Cause as you said, you're focusing on executable. So I'd imagine it's exes, scripts and DLLs. Am I close?
Yes.
Yeah. So what if you just did a frequency analysis, right? Show me the 10 least prevalent executable files in my environment. I mean, that's probably going to be more useful to you, right? Straight up finding them And running them in a sandbox is probably going to get you more value than any threat intelligence feed. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think it's pretty close to how a lot of threat hunters want to work. Maybe they don't want to start that way, but maybe I just honestly, I never want to see a file that's on more than 10 systems, period. You know what I'm saying? And so like the ability to...
But that's what I mean. That, say you find, yeah, you know, there's five files that only appear on three boxes each, right? Like that's, I'd imagine that's just going to be, if you just fire up your stairwell, you know, Inception console, you know, once every couple of days and do that exercise, stuff's going to show up there.
Yeah. And then you start to decorate those with YARA rules too. And you say, now I'm not only seeing the rare objects, but I'm seeing the ones that have these anomalies. And I've detonated them. And then there are additional runtime anomalies that are happening. And so you start to have these different ways to, you know, generate this own insight, like from your own data rather than from other, you know, the outside in.
Okay, so like what I'm asking you to do, right, and you're resisting, which is cool, it's fine, is to basically really give a slap to threat intel feeds. Okay, and I get though that a threat intel feed might give you that first string to pull on, right? It's not useless. I've never said it's useless, but I guess the point is there's more and more stuff we can do these days that doesn't necessitate threat intel as being a big part of it, like threat intel feeds, I should say. What we're talking about here is a way of getting something actionable out of a very simple thing, which is to show the least prevalent, executable files in an environment, right? And I just feel like, you know, these are the sort of approaches that will probably get us further than trying to enumerate lists of bad IPs, which are always changing.
Yeah, I for the most part agree, you know, for sure. I'm not a super hard liner on it because I don't want to piss off.
I'm not either. And I imagine that,
friends,
you know, through your career, right, which is extensive in threat intel, I can imagine that you would have found some C2 infrastructure or whatever, rolled out that information to customers and wrapped up a bunch of campaigns, right? But obviously, again, you're coming from that government mentality. That's a win for the, that's a big win for the threat intel company. It's a big blow to the adversary, but it's not much of a win for the next company over that's getting hosed by a different crew that the threat intel company didn't flag yet. That's all I'm getting at.
Yeah. And I mean, the super chances are that the super duper targeted stuff, you're never going to see that in an intel feed in the first place. By the time it makes it to you, it might be 5 years too late, and there won't be hashes for the things that you're finding for the most part. So I do think like the idea of squeezing your own intelligence, squeezing your own data and producing some new type of security intelligence is kind of awesome, because it's your data and you're making sense of it and you're in searching it and you're able to just come up with all these new insights that you're not getting from anybody else.
Are you extending the graph beyond file info, right? So say you throw something in a sandbox and it spits out a list of IPs and domains, because that's something that you can often get from a sandbox analysis. Is there a mechanism within Inception to do anything with those additional indicators?
Yes. We're obviously growing the graph in different ways.
Yeah.
I think everything starts with a computer, right? For me, it's like, that's where we want to get to. So that's where it starts, right? Everything starts with the computer. Then you have the files. And then we have everything that kind of grows up on top of that, whether that's IPs and domains and sub hashes. Maybe we take files and we unpack them. And now we have a sub file that gets detonated in a sandbox. And we can kind of look at that too. And everything's going to kind of, connect back to a computer. So maybe you do have an indicator feed too, a threat intel hash feed, and it's saying, here's a hash. And oh, by the way, you know, this was seen as unpacked from this file, as was unpacked from that file, as was seen on this asset.
Or you and start with an IP and you say, well, actually one of the analysts, saw that IP when they ran something through a sandbox, and here it is on the graph.
Right.
And these are the files it connects to. And, you know, this is what I'm getting at. Like, this is where it gets really interesting. And that's why I was saying about threat intel. To me, it's always seemed like, you know, a possible thread you can pull at, but it's not so great as a primary control.
Right. Yeah, it kind of depends on, you know, what you're using as your starting point. But I think for a lot of times, you know, people are just not getting the value out of it when they use indicator feeds as starting points.
So right? I'm curious, right? Because you're talking about being able to expand out this graph. At what point do you start pulling in like Zeek logs and stuff to this thing? Because I know you've started just with files, right? That's the pitch. Yeah. We do files. But, you know, you are talking about expanding out into a you know, graph-based approach, which is going to be able to handle things like domains and IP addresses. I mean, you call them indicators. I'm chummy with Rolf Temming, so I would call them entities, right? So Multigo style. So at what point do you start ingesting different forms of data?
I think we're 100% going to take in entities of all sorts and start making relationships with those, because that's really where analysts are able to ask questions and get answers back at multiple layers in the graph. I don't really know about, you know, things like logs and such, but I can say that, you know, I am particularly interested in more than just files, you know, such as executables in memory, perhaps, or things that never land on disk. I think those could be really fruitful. And, you know, I think we want to grow out this thing from files and to memory things and into other types of entities.
I mean, you probably won't need to ingest the logs yourself if you've got, you know, because everyone's building nice APIs right now, right? So same way that you're just throwing files at a sandbox through an API, you might be able to throw IP queries against network gear, you know, through an API query.
Yeah, we're definitely, you know, everything for us is really API based, right? For what our own web app uses the APIs, our endpoint, you know, forwarders use the APIs as well. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of possibilities to grow there. But what's, you know, the challenge there, and the challenge we're really trying to address, is to make search the number one thing, right? Search, your data has to be searchable or it's not worth having, in my opinion. And we want the search to be searchable in ways that analysts love to search data, right? They want to ask these sometimes not intuitive questions, and they ask questions of data that's different than how engineers ask questions of data. But if you're a threat analyst, you're a threat hunter, you're a SOC analyst, you're an intelligence analyst, you've got all these ways that you want to interrogate the data and search your own data. And like, you know, for us, it's bringing the power of search to a lot of your own data so that you can create your own intel.
So, Steve Miller, to sum this up, I guess, you know, this has been an interesting chat because we've kind of looked at the early history of the threat intel thing, which was frustrated people in government coming out to try to, you know, at least give some of these extremely prolific Chinese APT crews a hard time. Mission accomplished there. But, you know, things have kind of moved on. Threat intelligence is still useful, but maybe not, you know, the start and the end of the game. And more tools like this, you know, that allow you to do your own threat intel are sort of evolving and becoming prevalent in the market. I mean, that seems a fair summary of what we've said today. What do you think?
Yeah. And again, you know, I think like, you know, antivirus and EDR and the NDR companies and people doing incident response, they're all coming out with this really great threat intel. And everybody, and there are more and more companies out there producing it, and it's coming out in more and more forms. You can buy, you not only are you getting MD5s, now you're getting the SHA-256 and the SHA-512 and the SHA-384. And so there's just more and more of it, and there's more and more companies producing it. And to me, this really speaks to people, you know, to consumer demand. People want intelligence, but they want it in ways that they can apply. And I think they're looking around for places to apply it. And what's more, as you know, MITRE ATT&CK and TTPs become more consumable, I think people are really wanting to create their own threat intelligence or their own security intelligence or security knowledge. And they want to do that by massaging their own data and understanding their own data and searching their own data so that they can generate the starting points for finding evil themselves. And I think that's a good direction and a hopeful direction for the industry as a whole.
It's interesting though, because this whole time I've been like, you know, kind of shading threat intel, which is as I do, but you know, you make a very good point, which is there's a lot more of it now, thanks to the NDR and the EDR vendors and the AV vendors and things like that. And now you can take signals. I mean, being able to operationalize just a, you know, maybe a low confidence signal out of your EDR suite, you know, if you want to consider that threat intel, you know, But yeah, being able to operationalize that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think like long have consumers kind of left intelligence production to all these vendors. And because they, you know, you're out there and you're buying intel and you're realizing I don't have control over this. It's coming to me so slowly. I don't have it in a way that will last. Now I have to write my own YARA rules rather than, you know, a vendor producing them for me. And they're just like, people are wondering, like, what can we do that's really going to be worth our time? Yeah. And where can we apply it? And where can we codify it and automate it where it makes sense? And so my guess is a lot more people will want, you know, that search of their own data. But, you know, I think they're going to demand that vendors start, you know, start giving me detection rules that I can tweak, that I can manage myself, because, you know, you doing it for me is only creating false positives and false negatives. And I want to manage, you know, that rock curve for myself. I want to be in charge of my own destiny and my own data. And
freedom. All right, Steve Miller, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on the Soapbox. I found that a really interesting conversation. So yeah, it was a real pleasure to chat to you, and I'm sure we'll do it again one day. Cheers.
Great chatting, Patrick. Take it easy.
That was Steve Miller from Stairwell there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Stairwell for being a Risky Business sponsor. And that is it for this edition of The Soapbox. I'll be back next week with another weekly news edition featuring Adam Boileau and Dimitri Alperovich. HD Moore is the sponsor guest next week too, so make sure you check that one out. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.